cost to commission me to do a limited edition lithograph for the class.
Well.
And don't do it out of the kindness of your heart.
You don't have to answer right now. You can think about it.
Well,
I want cash prizes now.
Here we have my
Well, all right, let me put it this way. I am right now making an arrangement with a new agent down in Portland to make some prints.
You have to talk with him.
And, well, no. But it's a little more costly. It takes a lot more work than you think to do a new print. So I think, although these prints are a lot more elaborate than a regular print, because they're going to be three-dimensional pieces, editions of three-dimensional pieces, I think that the cost, not counting the stipend to the artist for that, is going to be roughly $4,500,
$5,000.
Already scraped that up. So, the materials, let's say I wanted to do an edition like that, and I wanted to give you guys a piece for the cost, okay? But I didn't even want to pay myself for it. The cost of the plates and the inks and materials of that kind probably would come out, let's see, we have 19 of us and 25. It probably would come out to something like a minimum of four or $500 to cover materials, time, and stuff like that. Without
per
giving
person?
Me, no, for the whole edition. For the whole edition. So that's divided by, say, 20.
How about a sketch?
Sketches are unique things. That's something else.
We can Xerox.
How about writing in our journals, Lori?
Writing in your journals sounds like a real good thing.
And also about the third option, when he's on the cliff and he says, oh, I only have two choices, and then he realizes that he doesn't just have two choices. It's not black and white.
I looked at it as the question as of the book, what's Kinahata? And I went to the author, and I thought that the author was someone who had felt really, really comfortable about knowing themselves, had learned all these things in a lesson, all lessons of life, and was clever enough to write it into this story, to make it criticize, ridicule all these little things in the real world by using this story. And in that way, it wasn't as much of a shocker that you kind of went across one thing at a time, and you could follow the person in the book. Of first, he just really didn't want to accept things, but then if you looked at him long enough, that he began to see that thing. And we kind of looked as dreams standing for knowing yourself, and we related it to kind of when he went back into the world. It was like, here's such a rational choice you can make. That seems to be the best thing, you know. Is he gonna fall back into the pattern, or is he gonna make a conscious attempt to use what he's learned? And we related that to the us going back to PLU. Are we gonna think, okay, now we know ourselves, now we can live our life again, all these things that we like, or are we gonna consciously look at things? Are we gonna look at what we learned as tools and as being able to change?
We talked about Ada, and then we thought that everyone could go there. We didn't discuss if it really existed or not, but we felt it was more of a spiritual journey to your own little place, and that you probably went there more spiritually than you did physically. We liked it how throughout the book, but then especially at the end, he made you. He believed in his dream so much that he made you believe in it too. He compared it to Black Belt's vision, how he went spiritually to the six grandfathers, but he was really sick all all the time, and his body never left the tent. We also thought, would we all go to the same audit, or would we all go to different audits? We didn't really decide. We were just wondering. We all liked the transition that he made from being really superficial and something that we couldn't really admire to deep, even to the point of telling the truth, even though it meant that his life would be taken for it. We felt that if he hadn't told that truth, that he'd probably go right back to where he was before and live the life, and the whole audit experience would be just a waste. And finally, we got into a long discussion as no Christian aspects were in the book at all. It was the audit religion. And it worked so right, and they believed it so much, that we began to wonder, is Christ the only way? Would the hero go to heaven in the end? He'd changed so much. He'd turned from bad to good so much. But yet, he'd also killed Connie. Would he still go to heaven, even though he hadn't asked Christ for forgiveness, as far as we knew? So we never figured it out, but it's just a question.
Be interesting to think, even if it doesn't mention anything about Christianity, is it in fact a Christian book? Is it a mirror? Sorry, Michelle. Maybe I didn't say it clearly at the time for you, but sometimes when we talk about birth, death, black, white, there's that opposite that really helps us address what we have. So that's another thing to think about while you're going back and searching through what happens.
When we were discussing the book, yes, Christine kind of brought it up, the comparison between the Kinnevada and the Mormon religion.
And I don't know that much about the Mormon religion, but we got off on a tangent, and we started talking about a lot of comparisons. I don't know if you guys know much about the Mormon religion, but he's from Boise, he's from Salt Lake, and it was really interesting because there's a pre-earth, and then there's the earth, and then there's levels of heaven, but between levels of heaven there's a place that Mormons believe that they can they go, and they actually go back and teach people that haven't maybe done the right way in the world. And it's much like this, you know, this nice place is much described like Ada is. And it's just really interesting because in the book there's a place that says that they dream for other people on the earth. And that's exactly like the Mormon faith, where they go back and they kind of like become that person, and they baptize them in the Mormon faith, and I, you know, just like baptizing the dead. There's a lot of parallels. We thought that was really interesting. And we also came up with some other ideas.
There was a part in the book that Levi Tom about when, you know, the book was almost believable in a lot of parts. You know, a lot of things we wish, it was kind of like a dream world, but it was really believable. And there was one part that, I guess, one of the old men was telling a story or something, and he was talking about Christ as like a trickster or something. And how are you saying it? That like, he wasn't one of the characters.
Yeah, the book had a lot of kind of seemed a lot of parallels in Christianity about, you know, the being saved and, you know, the fall and then coming back and things like that. But I definitely don't think it was Christian, because just, well, you know, they mentioned or made an allusion to Christ, and talking about his healing is kind of a watered down trick. Not really something as pure as on Ada. It was just like, well, you know, he's kind of a watered down trickster.
Can I say something about that? They weren't saying that it was Christ. They were saying it was the people that wrote the Bible. I mean, that through the writing, that the purpose that they thought Christ had done that was watered down
filtered through our society, because I had heard, they said that at the point of that, it was the loaves and the fishes. And they said that the point of it was the sharing, not the miracle. And I had heard that before in church before, that it was partly the people that wrote the book. They weren't going against Christ. I didn't.
Yeah, because it went through so many different translators.
Yeah, and the writing.
Well, just because it was written.
Yeah,
it froze it.
No, it still bothered me. I mean,
it bothered you.
I mean, I had
good.
Regardless of whether I misunderstood it or not, just when I got to that point, I just had to stop reading, and for about 5 minutes, I just kind of fumed, and then I could go on.
I think that the thought that June's group brought up about, you know, they didn't really say what there was the religion of Ada. But it was right because they believed in it. In the same way that they could have different stories of evolution and creation, but they're both right. And we're so thinking there has to be a right and wrong. But maybe every religion that, you know, if they believe in it, then it can be right. And to try to accept that and not have to think that everybody's wrong.
Another interesting kind of parallel is yesterday we were talking about surrealism and the Dadas and how it was the art at that time, it was capturing the mood because people were just starting to really doubt and to really doubt the things that were going on in the real world because the world looked to know all the disillusionment that was going on. And just like Ada, I mean, it seems to reach out to those people that are really doubting.
I like to talk about what you said, Kai. We're struggling with that. And we're struggling with the idea of, you know, putting all the religions together and then kind of coming up with some kind of autonomous religion, you know, that covered everything. Versus, like, Christianity, which in certain ways is very specific, and it says, you know, you believe Christ is the only Son of God that died for our sins, and only through his blood we're saved. And, you know, he says he's the way, but did he really say that? And, you know, the struggle between those. And, you know, they did bring up Christ in Ada, and then they kind of, in a way, just kind of shoved it off a little bit. And, you know, was that really, I don't know, you know, were they really accepting Christ that way?
I need to say something here, because I think there's something real important in what this discussion is talking about. I'll express my point of view and see if it sort of adds anything to it. If there is some great sort of insightfulness, some great light, some divinity, something that we can sort of address in some way, call it whatever we will, God or Christ or Buddha or whatever, and that thing becomes a inspiration for which many different cultures choose a metaphor to express. It could have been Judaism, and it could be Christianity, and it could be Zoroastrianism, and it could be Taoism, but it's all these are metaphors for expressing this one particular great point. By looking at the metaphors and trying to take all the metaphors, put them back together again to find a way of looking at this oneness. It's sort of like taking all the black and white pictures in the world and expecting you're going to put them together and come up with color. That if we accept these as metaphors, at least theoretically, as a way of then looking toward this other kind of divinity, we might be able to get a better understanding than trying to look at all the various filters, which are, by definition, something that has removed something out of it in order to understand it. In order to bring something into language, we have to take something from our imaging world and eliminate it, because it's part of the process of putting words down. Looking only at the words means that we never do get a chance to experience that other part, that unconscious part, that intuitive part. So as you look at all the religions as metaphors, we also have to realize that maybe they are metaphors, and what they're really talking about is some other kind of feeling about it that does not exist in any particular dogma. Whether it's a Mormon dogma, or the Hindu dogma, or the Jewish dogma, or even the Christian dogma. And I think that's an important part of looking at that, looking at it metaphorically. Anyway, that's just a point I wanted to raise.
When you truly believe in your own metaphor, at least in Christianity, if you, it seems like you're saying, you know, you can accept everyone else's, but you have to truly believe in your own. But if you truly believe in your own, there are certain things, like Brent was saying, certain specific things in Christianity that say that Christ is the only Son of God. Things that say, go out and teach all nations. how can you, when you're truly believing your own metaphor, and if you truly believe that and follow that, how can you accept other metaphors as being?
Well, I guess it depends on your interpretation of what the information is, and that's something that just within Christianity, people have been talking about ever since Christ walked the earth. So that's one we really can discuss at some point, but not one we can draw any conclusions for. But for me, my personal point of view is that when you accept, let's say you accept Christ as your personal savior, then you have no choice but to believe in Christianity, because in that sense, Christ is Lord. But if you haven't accepted it, then maybe you can live a Christian life in a different, and call it Hinduism. And you cannot be anything, you have to accept your own point of view. To me, it's a metaphor for being yourself, accepting who you are. Once you know who you are, then you have to be who you are, no matter what. The other specific things you talk about are like I say, we could discuss there. In fact, our whole volumes of the books of the Testament that were eliminated from the New Testament that say completely different things, written at the same time the books of the New Testament were written. It's just a political decision was reached at one point, deciding what's in and what's out. And we could talk about what that means and what that means in terms of the message of Christ too, but the most important thing is what your own personal belief is. And if you feel that you must bring Christ to the world, then you should do it.
But I think we're looking a lot too much black and white. We're looking at Christian or not Christian, and I think of it as a little bit of, from the, going back to geometry class, you did not say if something is true or false, you said if something true or not true. And there's that fine line between not true and false. And I can see people who are not Christian, who are, it's not that they're, you know, it's false, totally off, but it's just that they're not true. They're not totally
true to you.
True, yeah. I think of the different religions, I don't, religions, that. People as true or not true, and I don't think there's a false. Or if you put a false on it, you're missing a little bit.
There, real good point.
Thank you. Saul, through his work, he's an artist of some renown. comes from a small college south of Seattle. And he's been working in the field of visual arts for some time, and he's going to give you the LG retrospective. Now, this retrospective you can look on as a metaphor. Okay? So the LG retrospective is about to take place, and without much ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Laurie Gold. Hey.
I should say a few brief words about them before I get into it. I'll try and make it as brief as I can. I don't really have that much time. But my reputation precedes me, I hear, to the whole village. I'm going to show you all kinds of work, starting with the earliest piece is a piece I did in high school. And I go from high school all the way up through just a year ago.
Through middle age.
What I've chosen to show you are some bad things and some good things. I've not really eliminated very much, so you get a better idea of the kind of work I did and where I came from and what it was about. I've done this presentation so many times that I no longer know what I need to say, what I can say, how long to stay on the slides, or anything like that. So what I'd rather you do is I'm going to go through them fairly quickly, because I have like about 130 slides here to show. And I don't think we need to sort of spend much time on any two or three of them individually. But if I'm going fast, you want to say something, you see something you want to talk about, then please stop me. I've seen these so often that I don't have to look at them any more than about 10 microseconds before I've seen enough. So,
All right.
10 microseconds, but we've done about half.
Do we need to write on this board?
You don't have to write on it if you don't want to, but it is something that you're experiencing in the class, so I would assume that would make it somewhat valuable.
Some kind of comment in your journal.
Okay, you'll also notice that my slide quality gets better. This is 1964 or 5.
Wow.
Who's the artist?
Wow.
Did these up?
Pardon me?
Did archaeologists?
Yes. Actually, my mother still has this.
His
this is a piece that got me a scholarship to the Art Institute of Chicago. Chicago, which I never used, but that's like where it starts.
The beginning of his liberal
Lori,
career.
Who is it?
Who is that? It is nobody in particular. It probably was the person I wish that I really could be, but wasn't. This is more like 65, moving on to 66. You can tell what I'm
saying. Yeah, right. It wasn't the Arby's.
I've jumped ahead now. After I played around with being an astronomy major, a literature major, a political science major, a psychology major, a music major, a theater major, I decided to become an art major and went off to art school. And this is sort of one of the things I played around with as a student at the Kansas City Art Institute. Before I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, I had my guitar case, and I used to travel in a group, a folk group, and so I thought, why not attract a lot of attention to myself? After all, that's why I was doing it anyway. I painted my guitar case, and in fact, what had happened is that my guitar case was stolen. They took the guitar out and left the guitar. I was rather complimented by
that. Guitar out.
Let's see, this is, I did this in school too. It's a great slide. All you can see is the reflection of the flashbulb. Yeah, the curtain's real nice too.
Lori, what is that? Is that a collage?
It's a collage. It's a three-dimensional collage. It's all just sort of junk I had lying around in my room. It was under my bed gathering dust.
Lori, is that Grace Jones on the bottom? Who's that black woman? Right there.
It's not. It's Gavin Kirk.
Oh, actually, it's some black model, and I don't remember what her name is.
No.
Well, we can move on. We don't have to look at the detail. This is an upside down slide, but it's okay. I come back from art school now, and I went back to a liberal arts school, and I was real into mouths and tongues, and we can discuss that forever and ever, but suffice it to say that it's just another example of metaphor. But at any rate, here we are. I was really involved also trying to electrify them, so that was a cast resin piece that now it's right side up. This is turned on, the one before it was turned off, so the tongue actually illuminates.
This must have been the 60s.
A self-portrait back from that particular time.
Oh, wow.
You're older than Adina.
You might say that. Yes, I think I've been getting younger and younger all the time. This is a huge one. It's sort of embarrassing. It's 48 inches tall and probably about 32 or 33 inches wide. In fact, I did another one that was more like 52 inches square that still hangs in my mother's house. That's very embarrassing. It's over the guest bed, so anyone who comes
in. Lori's room.
More tongues. I found this old French door lying in the street. So I covered it with fake fur and did these mouths on them. And I did strange. I wish I had the door back again so I could take all this stuff off and install it in the house. They're real valuable. This is upside down too. Everyone stand on their head and you'll see this one. This is actually a plaster cast of my first wife. I sort of put her in this box and covered it with fur, and there's black satin all around it. I don't know if I sort of knew psychically what was in store for me or not, but it rubbed it. It's sort of a neat looking piece, but it's sort of funerary.
It's a lot of fur.
There we go, it's a close up. Let's move on. I also liked doing sculptures back then. This is an old computer throw up, actually. They were throwing out this computer at the University of Illinois. You remember, those of you who saw 2001, that's where Hal got his ancestry from. They had a real nice computer program there, and my brother was in it. So when they were disassembling the computer parts, he sort of grabbed some and threw them in my direction. And so I took them and reassembled them and put plexiglass around them and developed this this particular piece, all kinds of layers and things. I do this now, in fact. It's something that has come back to me. Judging by the fact that everyone got quiet, it must mean that you sort of like this one instead of the others. But there's the top looking down. So you still see those old-fashioned plugs in there. It's real neat stuff. But at any rate, these were made of clay, plaster cast, made of them, cast in resin, and then covered with fur. The middle one I, in fact, gave to my cousin as a birthday present. I only have the two end ones, which still exist. They used to be on either side of the water closet in our bathroom until our friends came over with a three-year-old boy who went into the bathroom and came out screaming. We now have them in our living room. Susan keeps trying to edge them closer to the door, and I'm going to do that. Right now, the wide mouth has a seashell in it.
If you took that away, something else would take place.
I also did a lot of graphic design. This is in my old student days, and this is a cover for exactly what it says. I worked for the Board of Education Chicago. for a period of time. This is another poster for a show.
Oh my.
And, oh yeah, I threw these in because these are really weird. For the Division of Visual Education, they're doing these things about senses. So they asked me to do these illustrations for a slideshow about eyes.
Lisa, that reminds me of your shine.
Mm-hmm. Nose. And the mouth. Oh yes, I've just jumped ahead into grad school. This is a print. I did. I moved to the University of Wisconsin in Madison and started grad school there. And these are all rather out of sequence, but this is one of the earlier prints I've done. I did a series that I thought was critical of technology and sort of making fun of American history. And while I was there, they had discovered the Merrimack at the bottom of the in the mud of the Mississippi River. And this is called Merrimack's Revenge. Merrimack is one of the Civil War. Have you ever heard the Battle of the Merrimack and the Monitor?
Yeah.
Those two famous Civil War. Precursors to the submarine. This was about Ben Franklin. I forgot now what it was called. You're going to see a lot of quilts and socks, and they're out of sequence, but let me explain why. While I was in grad school, I had this terrible ingrown toenail, and I could not walk, and so I spent a lot of time lying down in bed and paying a lot of attention to my feet. So somehow socks came into it, but we'll jump back into that in a little while. This is the last flight of the Lindbergh.
His dream told him.
It's a sort of strange kind of polluting technology, oozing oil and weird fumes all over the countryside, but barely able to float. Like, I wouldn't want to be underneath it in that landscape because this was chugging away above me. But anyway, we'll move along here. This is called Making It Right, as in the Wright Brothers. There are some other symbols there that you probably can recognize fairly well that don't need to be commented upon. However, we'll move along. These are all prints right now, basically. I should explain what a print is since I talk about that. A print is a limited edition multiple. That is, the artist works on a stone or a plate or some kind and prints multiples of the particular piece. There is no original painting or anything like that, but they're not reproductions like the posters you buy. There's a real difference. And I could be more elaborate later on when I feel more patient about it. But right now, we'll just move on. This was a print called Pennies from Heaven. Not exactly like what I used to do, but I still kind of like that style. What I was basically doing at this point in grad school is polishing up my craft. So I've got my craft polished there. I don't know what else I could say about it. I still see that every once in a while when I go visit some of my relatives. One of the nice things about being an artist and being poor is you always have Christmas presents lying around. So I give them away readily, and that I still see. This is the one that I finally realized that craft isn't everything. There are 83 color runs in this particular piece, which probably don't mean very much to anyone, but it took me forever to do. And I realized when I was all done that the image itself really was kind of crummy. So why spend all that time doing something when the content isn't there? And that's sort of why my work started evolving as it is, much more into content than into style. But I'm not there yet in this particular case. This is a series of quasi-science fiction things that I had done called the Arkon series. What you see there floating ahead in a spaceship form is actually an ancient kerosene delivery wagon. All I did with it is I removed the wooden wheels and added a couple fins on the back. That area that you see, that strange kind of pink shape, which actually is fuzzy, it's flocked, is where the guy who would be riding around with the horses in front would be sitting. I sort of saw that sitting by the side of the road one time and thought it was just an amazing little shape, so I used it a lot. This particular print is the called She Emitted Sensors for Atmospheric Elements. It's the first award-winning print I ever made, and I still sort of like it even now. I still have quality about it. It's a combination screen print and lithograph, which I'll occasionally throw technical terms at you to impress you, so you don't have to worry about that. Here's another one of my famous mouthpieces. This is a pencil drawing, and I use the same image and reinterpret it in a lot of different ways in a lot of different places. But my major professor once said that the reason I did artwork was a poor excuse for making dirty pictures. And I think what he was referring to is the fact that I have a very strong sensual element that's there. I don't really think of them as being sexual particularly, but they are sort of voluptuous in shape and form, and oftentimes they feel like they'd be comfortable to lie around on or something like that. It's another pencil drawing. At this particular point, my work started becoming real autobiographical, as if it wasn't all the time, but now I'm more aware of it. This particular shape
for a lot of very complex reasons that we don't have enough time to go into, became a combination of an autobiographical image and a kind of image that represented my father. And I sort of developed a character that I called Oscar, who kind of was actually the name of my step-grandfather, but who became this character, and I'd often write short stories and illustrate them, and then the short stories I'd throw out, because they usually weren't very well written, but the illustrations were kind of neat, so this was one of them. This, the title of this one is a paragraph long, so I won't bother telling you. And there's that shape that we looked at before I said you'd see again. This one is called Bagged End. Those of you who have read the Tolkien trilogy, or The Hobbit, I guess it is, might sort of see the little pun there. But I had discovered the airbrush, the little tool that you will see now probably nonstop throughout the rest of the pieces. There are lots of particular kinds of uses of visual space and color and a lot of things like that that I use very, that I'm very conscious of using now that I wasn't conscious of using then. And I sort of look at this piece, not that I think it's a great piece of art, but that I'm really beginning to play with some tools there, some skill tools that.
What exactly, how do you use an airbrush?
An airbrush is a thing that is about the size of a pencil or a pen that you sort of use in your hand, much like you would a pencil or a pen, except it has a little cup that holds paint and is attached to an air compressor which pumps air. And what it does is it mixes the paint in the air and sprays out the pigment onto the surface. And it could be a very thin spray or a very wide spray.
So you can get very definite lines with it?
Well, you get very definite lines by masking certain areas out, much like you would if you were spray painting the side of your house, you'd mask out your windows. So that's what you do with the airbrush paint. This particular piece is a very tiny etching. It's actually about 4 inches by 3 inches or something like that. So, let's see, what this one is called Reinforcements Were Dropped That Afternoon. I'll just sort of keep going. It's another small etching. It's called North for the Season. I had a series of small paintings that I called The War Between the Argyle Socks and the Tootsie Roll Pops.
Oh no, that must be heavy.
This one's called It All Comes Out in the Wash, speaking of heavy. We'll move along.
Is that why he doesn't do his laundry?
Another one. This is just when you're in school, your teacher sometimes asks you to do things that you really don't want to do, and one of the things they made me do was a 7-color lithograph. And I waited until the day before it was due, and then I ran into the litho studio, and I figured the only way I'm going to get it done is to make it very small. So this is 4 inches square. Right? So I just redid what I'd already been doing all along.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. We're still in grad school, but we're maturing. Yes, we are. This is a screen print, but it's done in a multiple of 10, and you can tell it's three-dimensional. Basically, what I was playing around with is, and this is an important theme I might sort of underline, art that is accessible to people. I was not interested in all this elitist kind of stuff about art, where it's a way of proving how much you know or a way of making you sound smarter than everybody else. So I like art to be accessible, and one way to make it accessible is to actually make people be able to play with it. So in this particular case, I screen printed 3 or 4 layers of plexiglass with this cloud form, constructed it and surrounded it by this crushed velvet, and placed it in a puzzle-like situation where you can take this piece and hang it on your wall or leave it on your coffee table. And each of these pieces can be removed and turned 90 degrees, so the shape that you make can be determined by whatever it is you want to do. I really like the idea, and that idea has stayed with me now, but in more in a conceptual way than in a kind of playful way. Theo, was it you that had the block?
Yep.
I mentioned about the block. This is my takeoff on the kids' block. I thought the kids' block was a real important part of my childhood, too. But I reinterpreted the images. Instead of having letters or numbers, I sort of used what I considered to be, at the time, archetypal pop images of the culture. I made these boxes out of wood form on the outside. I had layered pieces of plexiglass. There are 3 layers of plexiglass slotted in, and then I covered it with fur. They stand about 12 inches cubed, and I made about, 24 of them. All of them sold. I don't have any more of them anymore. So at my MFA show, there was a corner of the gallery. It was just sort of piled up with these pieces, and people could come and stack them up and let them fall over, and it was really a lot of fun, except that plexiglass is very heavy, so they weighed a ton.
Lori, what were some of those images?
Besides the 3 you see, you mean? Or
well,
what?
I see a Sunday and a...
You see a Sunday with a cherry on top, which is a real kind of comic book image that we were lips, you know, me and Miles. The idea of arched doorways were something I probably was responding more in terms of a lot of the psychedelic kind of images of entrance into another world. I'm sort of past that by now, but it sort of became a corny image. I was trying the other day to think about what the other images were. One of them was a kidney bean, because that sort of shape has also entered into the pop mythology in a way of time. And I can't remember what the other two were.
Lauren,
yes.
Is this your childhood shrine?
Well, in a way, a lot of my work is about that, and there are some specific pieces that are much more shrine-like later. But yeah, I was sort of going back and reliving important parts of it. Then too.
When was this, Lauren? I mean, what?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. She's probably 73, 72, 73.
What's your fascination with the fur?
I think it's part of my the sort of fascination with anything that's sensual. I just like the way it feels. I like to kind of curl up with it. I like to touch it. You know, it just makes me feel nice. And I had dogs, two large German shepherds, who appear in one part or another in my work, and it was sort of part of that too. My house used to be covered with fur. Everything was covered with fur. Either it was fake fur I put there, or dog fur I didn't clean up. This is a print. It comes complete with hair, I see. I used to wear this pith helmet a lot, and there was this,
pithy.
Very pithy, yes. This is about the time that my first marriage was breaking up, and I didn't really know what to do with myself, and someone said, well, why don't you do self-portraits? And I did some self-portraits, which I don't have slides of, but I thought more than do a self-portrait about what I look like, I thought it might be a better idea to do a self-portrait about what's going on inside. So I used the pith helmet as a kind of personal symbol, and there my Tootsie Roll Pops are sort of slightly redefined, and I kind of thought about wanting to clean house and re-plow and plant my field, if you will. I don't mean to sort of get too metaphorical there. And so this one's called Autumn Cleaning Out to Play, and it was kind of my way of breaking loose with some of those feelings. A lot of times you'll find you'll be feeling something, and all you have to do is talk about it, and it sort of goes away, or you can understand it better. With me, it was easier to draw about it and to talk about it. That must be the same here, but this is a small print. This is one that's in the collection of the Art Institute of Chicago, and it's, I don't know, about 15 inches high, so it's about 22 inches wide, I guess. The paper is. The image is smaller. This is called, well, actually, before I tell you what it's called, I should tell you a bit of the story. I don't like telling you much of the story of the artwork because the work becomes less literal later on, but this one has a story. I had a roommate at this time who was a woman photographer. And she was one of those people who many of you may have friends like this who like to take photographs. She could not experience the world except through the lens of her camera. So if it didn't happen on film, it didn't happen. I imagine that if we had gone out on a picnic and suddenly the world came alive like this, if she didn't have her camera there, she'd just sort of keep eating whatever her sandwich was. So this one is called, Gosh, It's Really Too Bad We Forgot the Camera, Pass the Mustard. I never knew how she felt about it, actually. This is another print. It's getting rather large. It's a screen print. Real large for screen prints, anyway. About 26 inches square, something like that. Now, the work is still personal, but I don't know that it's necessary to talk about it, because what I'd rather you experience is the feeling of what it is and what your own relationship to it. It obviously has a kind of somber quality to it, but nonetheless, it's sort of peaceful and meditative for me. I still like that print, although that one never sold very well at all. Maybe it was too scary. The lightning bolt has become a real important autobiographical symbol to me, and this is just another one of the prints that used it. This is a lightning bolt that is stuffed, covered with fur, as you see, and the side has fallen open, revealing some very tender, fleshy part on the interior. I will say nothing more than that, and I'll move on. Oh, this is another one of my prints that was real popular, won an award too. This is called Heartburn, A Consuming Situation. I think it speaks for itself in terms of what it's about, but I really still like this piece too. I don't even think I have a copy of this one anymore. So if you know anyone who has one on their wall, let me know. This is a little tiny one that actually was the poster to my MFA show at Wisconsin. And I stayed up all night once, sort of getting this ready, and ran around early in the morning, putting them up. And the next day, they were all stolen. So I suppose that was kind of nice in a way, but I was worried that nobody was going to show up to my MFA show. I'm sort of, every time I throw a party, I have the same anxiety. No one's going to come.
I'm sorry, Larry, what's an MFA show?
A Master of Fine Arts degree. In studio in college and studio, they don't give doctoral degrees. They give a master's degree and then a master of fine arts degree. And this was sort of my terminal degree. I don't like calling it terminal degree. There's quality about it that I'm comfortable with. Anyway.
There's Oscar.
In a way, yes, this is Oscar. This is a small painting. I mean, I'm not going to get into what all these specific symbols are, but every last thing I threw in there for a reason. It's sort of embarrassing now. And luckily, I don't own this piece anymore, so I don't have to think about it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the airbrush technique that makes it, but it looks kind of like the movie Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
A lot of
the. I was wondering, like, is that just because of the airbrush or whatever you used, or was that?
It's probably more because of the landscape and the intense color than it is the airbrush itself. But it does have that kind of pop imagery. And basically what I'm trying to do, and sometimes consciously and sometimes not, is I want to create an image or an environment that is accessible to people so they can look at and enjoy without having to have to understand. So it's almost graphic art in a way. I was a commercial artist or a graphic artist for a while and had my own graphic arts firm. And I like the idea of popular art, except I like popular art that says something too, not just popular art that tries to sell or manipulate. So I try to weave those guys together. I think I'm much better at it now than I was then. But I'm still real interested in art that people can relate to on a lot of different levels. This is another one. It snows in Wisconsin, so all my art is drawn from things that I did. Often I would build sculptures. This particular star box, for instance, was one that I built. Fairly small, more like a jewel box, and then did drawings from it. Placed it in an environment. The rug that you see on top of that strange stuffed form was a rug I used to have in my living room. And the stuffed form itself was sort of the way I used to respond to my, at that time, best friend's old pink Nash Rambler. And it sort of felt like that to me. This piece is sort of about it. Ah, yes. Should I tell the story behind this picture? When I was in grad school, I fell in love with this woman. And who's still a very dear friend of mine now. And she was a textile person, did a lot of her own textile design, so she would have beautiful clothes that she had made the fabric and made the patterns and wear, and it was just a really, really neat person. We had gone out once when I first gotten an agent, and we were sort of celebrating. I took her out to the fanciest restaurant in Madison, which at the time was a step above Burger King. When I was done, I sort of had such a wonderful time that I just needed to sort of show her how happy I was, and I instantly went home and took out my sewing machine. My grandfather was a tailor, so I've been sewing ever since I was about 6 years old. And I made this, I took out all my scraps of fabric and fur that I had, so I have a big box of that, and I made this stuffed lightning bolt form. And I just, a pillow, sort of a way that I could metaphorically cuddle up with her at night or something, I don't know. At any rate, I made it all through the night, and at about 4:30 in the morning, I got back into my car, and I drove over to her house, and I crept up the three squeaky stairwells up to her, just her flights of stairs up to her door, and hung it on her doorknob with no note or anything, because I figured she'd probably figure out who else was crazy enough to do something like that. This particular piece is sort of about me pursuing her and the relationship. By the way, I never caught her as lovers, but I certainly caught her as friends, and I feel myself very lucky for having had that experience. All the fabric you see there is fabric that she used. And that stuff, lightning bolt times three, is sort of what you see there flying in the air. And it's called In Pursuant to a Rising Star. Mm-hmm. In fact, she went off and moved to New York and was doing some really nice textile work there. It has a beautiful loft and has since gotten married, has a real nice child. Anyway, I'll move on. At the time, she was in love with this really very kind of dark and passionate Lebanese man. This is sort of a continuation of the narrative there. He also was an army brat, and so you see the sergeant stripes in that oriental rug. And the final chapter of this is never mind what it is, but I'll move on. This is the last time I used that. This stuff lightning bolt appears in a couple of other pieces, but it's no longer as personal to me. It becomes just more of a motif. Getting on to the end of grad school, this particular painting. All the paintings you see have sold. I no longer have them, so the only thing I have are the slides of them. The agent that I had in New York all through grad school proved it was a real lucrative place for me to be because I was the only person I knew who was actually making a fairly good living off their art.
In fact, I keep telling Susan how enchanting my liquor cabinet looked, because I could afford to have such wonderful luxuries. Good wines, nice brandy.
In New York, too.
Good patches on my clothes was really good.
Top quality.
This is a painting. My early work often had to do with relationships with all my friends, but it didn't all have to be love affairs that didn't work out. And this is sort of a painting about it. I liked the painting a lot so much that I decided to make a nice print. So I made a print out of the painting. Yeah, this print is slides in backwards. But I like the print better than the painting now. It's a little clearer to me. It's called Sea Moss on a Cuticular Bag, Share and Share Alike. I'll let you chew on that one. And this is another print that was real popular. I only have a copy of this one. There's Oscar. You remember Oscar from before. I should say a little bit where the form came from. I had a friend who I think is still a friend, although I haven't talked to her in a while, who is also an artist in New York now, whose nickname was Cranberry. Because she was real, still is, real short with rosy cheeks. So everyone, and she used to roll around like this speedy thing going, a speedy cranberry rolling downhill. We all called her Cranberry, and she liked dolphins, did a lot of work about dolphins. So for a birthday present once, I made a stuffed cranberry. And in the stuffed cranberry was a little laced-up pocket that I put a can of cranberry sauce. And before I gave it to her, of course, and also I had appliqued little green dolphins in green velvet. I just loved velvet. It was the next best thing to fur. And I did a lot of drawings of it before I gave it to her, and this is sort of a reinterpretation of the drawings. And once again, it was a painting that I really didn't like much, but the print I loved. And that's the print. And the print is also one of the prints that I have that has won awards. So in fact, we still have one of these hanging in the house. It's one of the only things from that time that I still like. Nice deep colors. Right along. This is the piece that started my art career. I had this piece in my MFA show, and there was an artist who lived in the boonies of Wisconsin who would come into Madison to get his art supplies every month or so, and kind of like pack himself back into his house. That's my image of it. Actually, he had this rebuilt schoolhouse that was an incredible luxury place to live, as I found out. Anyway, he had an agent in New York, and he saw my work and liked my work, bought this painting, and got me in touch with the agent in New York, and that's when I really started being able to make a good living. What the agent in New York did is he would, what they call, publish my work. In terms of prints, what that means is I make an edition of prints, and the agent buys the entire edition outright. What that means then is I don't have to worry about going to galleries, I don't have to worry about finding someone to buy the work. He buys the whole thing, and he worries about selling it. So although he buys it for a small percentage of the wholesale price, it also meant that he bought all 50 or all 60. Mm-hmm. So you multiply that by even $40, and you've got a sizable lump sum of money. So I would go down to my basement studio, and I would basically print money. That's how it felt to me. I really loved it. So I felt like, oh, gee, I'm a little short for the rent today. I think I'll make a print. It sort of worked out that way. Anyway, moving along. This is a piece that was a commission piece. There is a friend of the jam, the person who I did that one piece about, the pursuant to a rising star, was having a passionate affair with a man who is a doctor and a writer. But many of you may have seen the book Mind in the Waters. He's one of the participants in that book. He's real into dolphins, too. And she commissioned me to do this as a birthday present for him. I still sort of like that piece. It's fairly small, because it had to be mailed. Yes, the quilt group. After I was done with my coursework and still working on getting my act together, finding a job and the rest, there's an awful lot of people who get MFAs and don't find work. Probably doesn't come as a shock to anyone. So there's a whole group of us that were around, and all of us liked to sew, and all of us liked to eat, and all of us were sort of aimless figuring out what are we going to do with our lives anyway. And we formed a quilt group. There were 12 of us, and we decided to make the quilt group called Night and Day. Each of us would do a day square and a night square in a multiple, so that we could all have squares to make our own quilt out of. And basically we would meet every other week, mostly to eat and talk, not to do anything else. And ultimately after, I guess it was 6 months, we all traded our quilt squares. It was a really neat experience to have, being very close with these people, sharing great vegetarian food, and then at the very end having these huge stacks, like pancakes stacked to the wall, of all of our various quilt squares. This was my day square. And this is my night square. And they all had their own day square, night square. And the idea was to put them together in quilts, but as we traded them,
we realized that not only were we such an eclectic and eccentric bunch that it was real difficult to unify them, that some of us had other ideas about maybe not making them into exactly quilts. So we all made them into
whatever.
Sculptures,
yeah.
Or quilts, or whatever we wanted to do, in fact. And we managed to get a show at a gallery in Wisconsin, or written up in Craft Horizons, I think, actually, back in, this is 76, I believe. And so I thought I'd show you some, this is what the quilt squares looked like. Some, what someone did is they made a slide portfolio out of them, which is sort of an in-joke for anyone who is in the arts looking for work, is you usually have at least a dozen or more slide portfolios made up, and you send them all around with your resume trying to get jobs, and then of course you get them back mutilated and chewed up, and usually two or three of them are gone, and they cost a lot of money. So anyway, our minds were all focused in on slide portfolios, so this is what she did. But at least you can see what all the, at least a glimpse of what the images look like. Some of them are hard to see in this slide, so it's difficult to tell. Yes?
Are they all made out of fabric?
They're all made out of fabric that is washable. That was the limitation, that we had to make them, and we all had to make them a certain thickness so that they could be easily sewn together if we wanted to.
How did the 1, 2, 3, the third row of that woman, how did they get it sewn with fabric?
It was photo screen printed with a special kind of ink onto fabric. The one next to it is about cars, and there's one about lemons and bananas, and there's sunrise and sunset in terms of colors. There's all kinds of things like that going on. They really were very attractive. It's hard to tell from this line. But this is another one. They someone who's this is Betsy's, by the way, Susan. Betsy Tuttle, another one of the members of the group, who is was her alter ego wasn't the lightning bolt, but a chicken. And if you saw her, you'd understand exactly why she looks just like a chicken with glasses. Anyway, so what she did is she had this one kind of chicken quilt that she had floating up in the air, and right below those two legs on a very nice little podium was a hand-crocheted chicken dropping that was so convincing that you started smelling it when you walked into the gallery. It was really quite nice. Eventually what she did is she removed the center part that has the chicken legs, put in something else, and used it as a quilt. I made a doghouse. This is mine. Since I had two German shepherds, I was very much involved with dogs. So this is a stuffed doghouse. It's all made out of there we go. And so I used the quilt squares for shutters and blinds and shingles on top, and had a lot of fun making the satin and fur bricks that went along with it. And I showed it to my dog Zoe, and Zoe looked at it and ran away. It was gone for hours. And I just thought I'd show you an installation shot of what that show looked like. Some people made pillows out of them, and then made fabric envelopes to put the pillows in, and embroidered on all the overleaves of the fabric envelopes, which you see on the wall to the left, were a repeat of whatever the motif of the particular quilt square was. We put a lot of work into it. In fact, I just mentioned this, that if you look all the way to the back, next to the curtain, slightly to the left, a man with a mustache staring in this direction with a camera in his hand. That's Neil Sandstead, the guy who became my business partner in graphic design, who is now the art director at WNET in New York. Anyway, that's my one claim to fame. That's the educational television channel in New York. This is a painting again, in case you couldn't tell. Fairly large one. This one my mother owns, so it's still around. My work now is beginning to get a little more involved in a kind of unconscious, more dreamlike area where I'm not concerned anymore with the specific narrative, but I am talking about things that speak to me in a kind of way. At this point in time, my work starts developing in an attempt to speak, let my unconscious speak to me. And often what I do is I make a piece without knowing what it is, and when I'm done, as I mentioned before, I look at it and it starts telling me things that I hadn't realized before. I don't know what more I can say about it exactly yet.
Wait, yeah, this is very Escher-like, isn't it?
Well, I always like what Escher had done to a degree. It's Escher-like in the sense that I use a repeated symbol or form. It's not Escher-like in the sense that what Escher was about is the mathematics of spatial illusion, which I'm not concerned with particularly, not the mathematics of it anyway. But he used a lot of birds and a lot of fishes. So in that sense, that's true. This is a piece you'll see reproduced in a slide, a print later on. And the only reason this one is still around is because my brother owns this one. It's nice when you have family sort of collect your work. I don't know if they really like it or not. They still think that maybe someday they'll gamble on me getting famous, and then when I'm dead, they'll sell it to somebody else.
What kind of
kind of significance do you have to the, like, the harnesses? I noticed some of them.
It's a real good point, Brent. I think that in a lot of ways, what I'm talking about, this particular one is called, oh, what's it called? I've forgotten now. I think it's called something like, it has something to do with flowing, or flushing something. I don't know. I can't remember exactly what it is. But I think what I'm talking about is feeling constrained, feeling that I'm not living up to my own potential, thinking that I'm keeping myself from being my full self. And so harnesses and ropes and things that pull are or somehow constrain a real part of a lot of my work at this point. Yes, Christine.
I've often noticed a lot of your creatives, with all the lightning bolts and stuff, it all looks like they're going to a specific place. And I don't know, I get the feeling of real action, like, I don't know if that means anything, but they seem to be going to some place.
I think that's another good point, as I like to look at my work as not an encapsulated piece so much as it's a snapshot of an event. And what we're doing is sort of seeing a kind of still photograph of something that is really in action or in process. But that's also a part of it. Also, one thing I use a lot of time is some form or something pointing at another object or event that is taking place outside of our field of vision, so that we start feeling like there's more going on than what meets the eye. I don't know what to say about that piece. It's not one of my favorite ones. In fact, I think it's a pretty crummy one. Recently went back to a gallery I used to deal with in Chicago and found out that they still had this painting stuck in a closet somewhere. Just as eager to get rid of it as I was not to see it again. So, although I think I'm probably going to have a show there next year, which is kind of nice to have a show in Chicago for a while. I moved to Buffalo, New York in this particular case. And this is about what it felt like to move to Buffalo, New York. It rained all the time. I hated the job I had. I felt like I was being consumed by my own inner fires of self-doubt and all the rest of that melodramatic kind of mumbo-jumbo, and left my girlfriend behind. It was all sort of like, what am I doing here, and what's it all about anyway, Alfie, or something like that. But I really like this piece. It, despite its ominous quality, it has a kind of heat to it that still resonates with me. It's one of those pieces I wish I still owned.
Ooh.
This one is called Adoration of a Curl, and it's, as you probably can tell, I like curly hair. I mean, there's Susan who has curly hair, and Kate who has curly hair, and this particular head is the head of my old girlfriend, Jane, and she has curly hair. We all sort of are idiosyncratic in our own way. She had done a takeoff on a Renaissance piece called Adoration of the Magi, and she did hers and made it Adoration of a Plant. And what she did is she changed the plant into a kind of magi-like image and stole the Renaissance border. And so I just did a takeoff on her takeoff.
Yeah.
Adoration of the curl, and the border is the same. Carrie, do you have a question?
Yeah, you like crabs?
Mm-hmm. She was a Cancer.
Okay, because he had crabs in another picture. They're really small.
Yeah, that was done around, that was about her in some ways as well. I figure I like the idea of decoration at this point. And so what I'll do is I'll find anything I can to decorate a surface and make a pattern out of it. And astrology was one of those things that I would sort of go to, is that it was filled with a kind of symbology that you could then make onto cloth and kind of decorate things with. In a way, it's sort of like when you're in your room and you decorate your room with all the things that are important to you, posters that you had, dried flowers that you got from somebody or whatever. And in a way, I populate and wallpaper my imagined environments with a lot of different symbologies that may or may not be important to me, but help kind of set a scene of some kind.
Did you realize that you were pretty much writing your life story into
the future? Yeah, I became very involved with speaking to myself in that way. I also kept intensive journals then too. But I think my visual dialogue was more powerful because I didn't make as many judgments or prejudgments about it. It was more automatic. This one was less automatic than a lot of the others, but most of them are sort of automatic. This one is called Harry What? It's actually an in-joke for artists. There's a group of Chicago artists in the early 60s that were called the Harry Who School. And since I came from Chicago and my work is similar in some ways, I'm often compared to them. And this particular piece is in the Elvium Art Center in Wisconsin. I like to sort of mention whichever anytime they get purchased by a museum. I'm in a lot of corporate collections too, the prints are, but I never know about that because my agent kind of dealt with that.
Those of you who are old enough may remember that in 1976, Buffalo was annihilated by 130 inches of snow that seemed to fall overnight, and it actually happened in about 2 weeks, I think. And this is a piece that, several pieces I did about snow and ice. This is a shape that I've used repeatedly. You may remember in the Heartburn, that print with the flaming hearts. It was sort of a heart that looked almost like a strawberry with those sort of tear-like shapes in them. This is a buried heart. Now the tears are more like lights that are sort of beaming out into sky. This is another one of my favorite pieces. This particular piece is actually owned by that friend Neil Sandstead I pointed out to you before. One of the nice things about having friends that make it big in the world is they can support those who haven't. And so he did in that particular piece. This is another one called Iceman, which I kept thinking about my refrigerator. Because there we were in the midst of all this snow
and ice,
and my refrigerator was breaking down. So here I was trying to keep myself warm while all my food was getting warm as well, and I just thought it was an interesting bit of irony. So I had all my food sort of stuck in an igloo on the back porch while I was waiting for the repairman to wait for the army to come and take the snow away. To get in there. It's really amazing in Buffalo because the only way they could get the roads clear was to bring in the Army Corps of Engineers. And they would take these huge earth-moving machines to take all this snow and put it in dump trucks and ship it off to Florida because there's no place to put it. Unfortunately, if there was any cars buried under the snow, they also did that to the cars. So they were divided in pieces and usually sort of left off to the side of the road. It was a real interesting thing. One thing that was really neat about Buffalo in the springtime after that snow I'll mention too is that garbage hadn't been picked up for about a month. So the garbage was in garbage bags also buried in the snow. So part of the snow that they would take and they would put, the only place they could find, which usually were parks, and the only place in the parks they could put them were like ball fields or something like that. So when the spring came and the snow melted, you had these huge garbage dumps sitting all over the city, sort of smelling like raw compost that was really delightful. Anyway, moving along. At the time, I was also still doing some album jacket designs. I had done some of that work, and this was a piece that was for an album jacket. I don't even remember the group anymore, who it was. It didn't matter, you know. I never dealt with the group. I just dealt with the advertising department of the...
You never listened to it, eh?
Oftentimes, I wouldn't. It's true. They'd tell me what they said that my work and the group were consistent, and they liked something like this, and I'd say, okay.
What group was that?
I don't know what group that was. So I
can't. I got that up.
My refrigerator, those little things keep coming back and forth. You notice that I'm starting to play around a lot with borders and edges. No one asked anything about the prints, but they all had irregular edges. I always hated the way things ended. You always have a square piece of paper, and then you always have a square mat or a square frame, and it just strikes me as being, why does the piece have to end? If I could have the piece just sort of fade off into the wall, that would probably be what I'd rather do. So since I couldn't do that, I would play around with ways of making the border become part of the piece. And that kind of motif in this particular case, there's a heart-shaped hole, so there's a that is sort of matted by the rest of it, and then we have this nice little decorative mat again, and then there's sort of a space that's indicated beyond that mat. So I sort of like to keep playing that illusion of things don't end where we think they end often. Another example of the same. This is another one of the pieces I really don't like much, except for the tubes. I still like those tubes. Okay, that's the end of that one. But you're not free yet. There's still... okay, faster. My wife says faster. And then there's that one. And then there was another one. My borders are beginning to take over. The piece is slowly getting smaller. Until finally they take over completely.
Wow.
This is a painting. This is called Good Night Irene.
Oh, wow.
I'd love to have a quilt like that, actually. But,
that would be great.
So doesn't it feel comfortable? I can just kind of relax.
Yeah, but do you know the words to Good Night Irene?
Depends. Yes, I do know. They're not very pleasant words. What
are they?
We'll sing it sometime.
No, we will.
Sometimes we get it.
I've got lead belly singing it, too.
At the same time that I'm in Buffalo now doing all this other sorts of work, I'm also falling in love. And this is a little card that I sent to this woman I was in love with who has since become the Susan you see right over here.
It used to be the Susan.
It used to be another Susan completely. We'll talk about that some other time. I just sort of jumped back in time a little bit. That my other curly-haired girlfriend that I was talking about, James, we decided to part ways in a kind of mutually agreeable fashion, and this was my way of purging myself of all that that meant. It's called a laying to rest, Carrie.
I don't know how to explain it, the things that are revolting, like her, they're in a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
Which is refrigerator.
It's refrigerator. Yeah.
It came from my refrigerator, but it became another metaphor for my section and capture. Or it became a metaphor for like feeling trapped or jailed or held down. And I thought what I was doing in this particular case is ridding myself of a lot of my symbology, which didn't exactly turn out to be true. But a lot of it, you see the crabs, and okay, all right, I heard that. This is a piece that's owned by the Albright Knox Gallery. Move on. This one's called Pause. P-A-U-S-E. I actually did one that's called Pause 2. I don't have a slide for that.
What year was that then?
That was, well, Pause, I guess that was, I did that in Buffalo, so that was 77 maybe.
Wow.
When I was at the Albright Knox, there was a show there, and I liked a couple artists, and I stole their ideas from them and put them together and made this thing. I don't know what else I can say about it. Somebody told me I'm running out of time. Oh, I got plenty of time.
No, you don't.
Oh. A small painting. Small painting. This is a print. I taught for a while at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. Anyone who has been in Saskatchewan knows how incredibly meditative that landscape is, even though it's rather boring, too, just like meditation can be. And this sort of sprang to me while driving in the country. Saskatchewan's a province in Canada. This is another, these prints are a combination of screen prints and lithographs. I lost my mind there for a moment. This one is called Comets Are Heavenly Bodies Too. No. While I was in Buffalo, New York, I received a grant to do a mural, and I had this large building to do it in, and as I mentioned before to some of you, I'm acrophobic, so I like to think that philosophically I chose to put this mural close to the ground so that it could be more accessible to people, but in reality I was scared to death. And as it is, it's like 40 feet in the air anyhow, and that's plenty high if you ask me. That's incidentally how I got to meet Susan. But,
Susan
was the assistant director of the agency that administered the funds for the project. And so she would come by and sort of visit the site, and I would flirt with her. That's when I was skinny.
She'd laugh at your face.
Anyway, we'll move along here.
She was probably sweet.
She had control.
It reminds me of your block.
She had many.
Yeah. I see that. These are all sort of paintings. I don't think I've still found myself yet. This is upside down painting. You might want to stand on your head again, or we'll just move on. Yes, I have moved to New York now, and at this particular point, my agent has turned into a crook. I moved to New York because he promised me $1,000 a month and all kinds of other advantages and stuff. He said, come, we'll make prints, I'll sort of give you shows, we'll have a real good time. And I said, okay. And I got there, and within 3 or 4 months after my arrival there, all of his checks started bouncing. And he had all my work, and it was really hard to get it back, which I finally did through dubious means. And lots of scary letters were written from lawyers and everything. It was really kind of horrible. Anyway, I was sort of there. I had nothing. I had no money. I had no job. I had no confidence. Susan and I were on the Alps. She had moved off into the hinterlands of Long Island, and I sort of didn't know what the hell was going on. And so what I was trying to do was say, okay, I need another agent. That's what I need another agent. So I would find other agents. I knew they were around because I'd been in the world enough to sort of know who they were. And I'd say, okay, what do you want me to do? I'll do it. Just tell me what it is, and I'll do it. Anything you want, I'll do it. And they knew that I couldn't do what they wanted because I only did what I did. But I didn't know that yet. And so I kept struggling to give them things. Whatever it was I thought they wanted, I would do. And although this work looks reminiscent of what my other work looked like before, it's very decorative. It doesn't have very much content to me, although this piece I sort of like
it
now.
It has the tears.
Looks sort of like the head of a moth now. But nobody really wanted my work. They kept saying that, yeah, that's fine, but I really don't think I can market it. And gee, we really respect you as an artist, and you're a real nice guy, but so long, buddy. See you around. It was not a real easy time for me, to say the least.
What I did do is I did manage to do a few prints here and there and find some way of sort of getting by. But the thing that finally did it for me is I decided I had a list of people who had purchased my work and supported me in the past. So I decided to become my own publisher. I made up some drawings of images, and this was one of the four images that I did. And I sent them a letter saying, hey, here's the black and white reproduction of the image I want to do. You pay me some money up front so I can get material. I will allow you to be able to choose any two of these four for $50 each. That is, for a mere $100, you can have two Lorigold prints for your very own. And they responded. And in fact, I collected something like $2,400. And I was able to buy my materials, make my prints. They all were happy with whatever two they wanted. And I still have some of those prints left over. And they have sold in other places and generated more funds, too. So that was a real excellent way of making part of my time in New York a little better. Remember that painting I told you?
Yeah.
Did
you design your ring with the
light? Sort of, yeah. The wedding ring, which is on this hand, Susan and I, we had a jeweler do the work for us, and we kind of worked real closely with her. And this other ring on this side was designed by my friend Betsy, you know, Chicken Lady. I traded her a painting for this ring and that funny hat that I sometimes wear around that she made for me as well. So she kind of addressed it to what she thought I needed. Of the four pieces, this is my favorite one. The prints are called Lies You Tell. The first one you saw was Lies You Tell. Let me see, I can't go back. Lies You Tell Your Friends. The second one with the waterfall was Lies You Tell Yourself. This one is called Lies You Tell Your Mother. And many of us have been constrained by the lies we tell our parents, and this is sort of about that to a degree. And this final one is called Lies You Tell Your Dog. Remember I said I had two German Shepherds? And actually, I always promised them that they would spend their last years in the country. And, well, let's see, it didn't quite work out that way for one of them. One of them didn't make it out here. We had to put her to sleep before we came.
Can I ask what the other dog's name was? It was Zoe, and who?
Shayna. For those of you who know anything about Yiddish, that means pretty. But I found out that just about everybody who comes from a Jewish background names at least one of their pets Shayna, if not one of their children. So I didn't name her that. My mother did. It was her dog originally. We'll move on. This is a painting I started in New York but finished in Seattle, and sort of the transitional piece. It's called East River Madness. And it portrays very well what it felt like to be living in the loft that I had there. It was a beautiful loft right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, overlooking Lower Manhattan, very romantic. Had a wonderful toilet throne that would be right in the window that overlooked all the nice traffic and all. It was just great on the other side of the river, so they couldn't look back at you.
This is but, a retrospective here.
Yes, but the water would freeze in the toilet in the wintertime, so it happens.
Is that
why
there's a wall, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure
it
wouldn't
be
able
fine.
To live there.
I'm
sure.
This is a black and white painting that was actually about John Lennon's death. Sort of hit me real hard. Most of us who grew up in the 60s were hit pretty hard by that, I think. So I got to Seattle, I started playing around with making my paintings really three-dimensional. It's hard to tell on the slide, but this particular one, which is called Caribou's Birthday Afternoon. Caribou is one of my names for Susan. I figure most people call their wives or sweethearts dear, so I thought it was only fair.
Good pretty word.
Now, these pieces now are getting dimensional. This is about three or four inches thick. The pieces are painted, cut, and sort of laminated with spacers, so they're beginning to get like shadow boxes. I was in theater, or shrines. I was a theater major for a while. I did a lot of theatrical design, and so in some ways they're very much like that. This is a fairly large piece. It's about 48 inches wide and about 30 inches high and about 5 or 6 inches thick. It's called Watershed, and it's one of the first pieces I sold here in the Northwest.
Interesting.
This one's called Albino. Also a laminated piece. I have some pictures, you'll be able to see some of that dimensional quality a little better. This is, what's the name of this one? This is basically, yeah. You want to say that louder? Toast Points and Gooch Brunch Throw a Party. It's basically about our wedding party. I'll move on from here though. I like to play around with illusions of what is painted dimension and what is really dimensional. And it's sort of hard to tell in some of my pieces, even when you see them up close. But yes, that's all I want to say about that one. This is a little tiny one. This is 12 inches on the side. It's also dimensional, but it's a lot of fun.
I think my imagery now is beginning to get a lot more powerful for me personally. It's a little less easy to recognize, a little less easy to understand, and I think it has a lot more room to just feel about. In fact, sometimes I think the more you don't see, the more you can feel. Zoe, the dog that stayed with us out here and actually did have a chance to spend her last years in the country, did get sick. She developed cancer, and over a period of 2 years, she was actually sort of slowly kind of going away. And I decided that as long as she seemed happy, I was not going to put her to sleep. But what happened is a lot of my attention was devoted to her or thinking about her. So I did a lot of work with her in it. This particular one is called Zoe's Dilemma. Don't ask me what it means, because I can't really tell you, except that I'm playing around with sort of imagery that comes out of my thinking about her. The ducks there I know is because when she was younger, she had a farmer that almost shot her because she liked duck, I suppose. I may be a vegetarian, but Zoe wasn't. Although Susan tried desperately to get it. She liked it, though. She liked watermelon and tomatoes. This slide isn't backwards, but this is called Spirit Dog. And as she was spending less and less time running around and more time sleeping, she would also be dreaming quite a bit. And I would sort of try and imagine what her dreams were like. And so I sort of saw her as sort of floating around in her dream state with bones and landscapes around.
They probably hate them.
This is a fairly large piece that's about 10 inches wide. It's called Zoe's Meditation. It weighs a ton. To give you a better idea of the dimension, you can see it from the side here. And you can kind of see how those pieces are cut and placed together. And you see the wood frame itself is also painted. Enough of that. This is called Altar Dog, talking about shrines.
When you showed the other day.
Right? Yeah, right. I might have showed this one the other day. I've got the back view of it, too. And this stands about, 18 inches tall. The base, I think, is roughly 22 inches square or something like that.
So it's Zoe died
yet? Yeah, no, she hadn't died when I made this yet. But that specter was looming closer and closer.
Do you have any dogs now, Lori?
Not now. Talk to Susan about it.
Just like her.
Her the bad guy.
This is another sculptural piece that's a little bit larger than that one. It's called Passion Fruit. One view is...
What year would this be?
This particular piece? 70s, 80... Mm. What is it? This is 86, so probably 84? I think 84, something like that. There's a kind of crunch. It's hard to see these in slide form because they're so colorful that the color defeats some of the space.
How does it take you to build something like that?
Hours and hours and hours. This, well, I can probably put a total of 120 hours in the just assembly alone. That doesn't include the kind of sketching part. And you can't work 120 hours straight. So those are in just just the assembly part. It doesn't include painting part. The painting part itself is something else. I can be working on several pieces simultaneously for a while. So the piece may actually take in real time, like a month.
What do you do with them after they're done?
That's an excellent question. Some of them, if I'm lucky, sell, and some of them have. The rest of them get stacked up in my office at school because our house is too small to hold them. They get real large, especially since they have plexiglass boxes that go on top of them. This particular piece, in fact, is one that hasn't sold, and I'm really glad. This is called The Shadow of Her Former Self. Mm. We'll walk around this one a little bit and see. It's roughly 22 inches square and stands about 12 inches tall.
Have these been shown in Seattle?
This one has, yes.
Uh-huh. See all the dog shrines?
Yeah. Yeah, they have. It's Stonecrest Gallery.
Stonecrest,
okay. So you saw where the bones were, so now we're kind of walking around the side. I also have a cat. We also have a cat, and you can see a little bit of Chutney there, their little, his little white legs dangling in the air. And as we kind of go around the corner, we'll see Chutney is being chased by the dog, which is a common kind of occurrence when she used to be able to run around. In fact, well, I won't. We're running out of time. I'll just, we'll continue on.
Are those brown things? Oh, that's a dog's head.
Yeah. Dog's head and bones. And you notice that this has fake grass all around it. I've become enamored with AstroTurf.
From black fur to AstroTurf.
This is a fairly large painting. This was done in 73, or 83, rather. It's called What's the Matter with Kids Today? It asks the question, it doesn't give you the answer, I think. This is
is a thing called Sidney's Bath. It really is sort of a self-portrait, really. And I've written a short story, and this is kind of another one of those examples of an image that occurred to me while I was writing. It's called Go Fish. This is another one of those paintings I started in New York and just finished in Seattle about 84, I think. I really rather like that one for some strange reason. This is a fairly large graphite drawing. One of the things I don't like about color is that it's so seductive that people will respond to color without really responding to content or imagery. And I wanted to try seeing what would happen if I used said something without using color. And although I like the image, most people sort of say, oh, gee, that's neat. Where's the color piece? Although I really like this one. It's called Princess and the Bird of Prey. I imagined what would happen if there we were over sleeping middle-class America and some incredible phenomenon happened in the sky, that it would come and go and they would sort of still be asleep. It's another one of my metaphors. And I call this one, Midnight Over Maple Drive.
Oh, what's the frame made out of?
It's AstroTurf again.
Shiny.
I'm almost done, guys, so it won't be long. This is also backwards by all these guys. This is a small print called Smokescreen. It's a print that is in a portfolio of former grad students from Wisconsin. We all kind of got back together again, put a portfolio of prints together, and it's sort of touring the country now in one show or another. I really sort of like that one. I'm ready to start doing some more prints now. Here is a small sculpture called Elemental, my dear caribou. Actually, the art department at PLU has purchased for their collection. So some of them do get out of my office. Here's a bat view. This is a piece called AKA Ramses. It was a commissioned piece, so I didn't have to worry about where that was coming from. Sort of a back view of it. I think I've got a front view of it too. It's a real nice piece. I like it.
Commissioned work, that means where is it now?
Some man had seen my work. In fact, he owns a stereo store. Uh-huh. And he said, gee, I really like your work. Could you make a piece for me? And I say, oh, sure, I could do that. What would you like? So I'd like a piece that fit on my speaker. Uh-huh. And so he told me a little bit about himself and what he liked, which I promptly ignored. But he did tell me what the size of the speaker was, so I made sure that the bass fit. He liked the piece, though. He got a good deal on it.
A good deal.
There was a show at Stone Crest about
the fish, right?
And they asked me to participate. So I made this particular piece, which was promptly purchased by, what's the name of the cartoonist who does the Far Side?
Gary Larson.
Gary Larson.
You're kidding.
No.
I love Far Side. That's cool.
He lives on Finney Ridge.
Yep. Well, you will find this hanging in his house somewhere. It's called his favorite chair.
Oh, an LG piece. How neat.
And when Zoe finally died, this is sort of my last piece about it. This was also bought right away, too. Sort of interesting to me that the pieces that wind up sometimes meaning the most and the pieces that sometimes mean the least are the ones that get sold. And I think this is the last slide I have. This is the last piece that I've done that I have a photo of. And this, I think, is my most powerful painting to date. It's called A Gift of an Unexpected Visitor. Are there any questions? Observations?
What is the gift?
The gift is the presence of the unexpected visitor. You'll notice in the painting there's a kind of shadow that's cast on that front stoop there, and so you don't know who it is. And somehow it seems to me that because this presence, this unexpected presence that comes by, it seems to melt the ice cube, share some, sort of illuminate the painting by it. I'm not quite sure I know specifically what it's about, but there's something about the gift in that presence of this person or the force that comes unbidden.
Is that a glass door?
I thought you meant present with a T, and that's why I thought.
Excuse me?
Is that like a glass door or a mirrored door?
It's a door that, if it looks glass or mirrored, then maybe it is. I didn't think of it that way. I thought it was a, so
solid piece of wood at the time. It's sort of like patterned after what my front door looks like in a way, although it doesn't look exactly.
Is there any connection between the flames and your lightning bolt?
I think yes. I think in a way the flames have become a more contemporary version of the same thing, the idea of passion and heat, especially passion and heat in a frozen kind of context. I mean, these particular flames are more like they're cast in plastic and illuminated from with a softer kind of glow. I'm not sure I know exactly what that's about. But all my work is about relationship at one time or another. Anyway, I can keep talking for hours. I think it's probably time I stop.
Before we part, let's give our visiting artist a warm